This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. This is where true crime meets history, with a twist. This time, we're investigating the Sandyford murder, a horrific crime in Victorian Glasgow. Please be aware that this episode contains material that some listeners might find distressing.
He's an old murderer. He did the deed.
She's been lying there all this time, and me in the house.
The guilty has got out, and the innocent is kept in.
My life's in your power, and yours is in my power.
Join me and my crack team of all-female detectives as we travel back in time and bring our present-day feminist perspective to historical crime. We meet real women from the past and ask, how do their lives resemble our own? What, if anything, has changed? And what can we learn from history that might benefit women in the future? We're heading to Sandyford Place, Glasgow. In 1862, it's home to the Fleming family. Three generations of Fleming men, all single, and their maid-of-all-work, Jessie Macpherson. It's Saturday the 5th of July at around 7:45 a.m. A boy approaches the house to deliver the milk. He's expecting to give it to Jessie the maid, who answers the door every morning, regular as clockwork. But not today.
I was there with the milk. I went up and rang the bell. Old Mr. Fleming answered it. He was dressed. He said he was for nay milk. He said nothing more.
Now, the oldest Mr. Fleming is in his 80s. He's the most senior family member. He should be taking things easy. What is he doing up, dressed and answering the door at this time of the morning? And importantly, where's the maid, Jessie Macpherson? To help us find out, here's today's guest detective. She's a stellar barrister who works in public, international and media law. She's represented actor Amber Heard and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, and she champions women's rights to tell their stories. I am delighted to welcome Jennifer Robinson to Lady Killers. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Now, Jen, you're known for representing, I guess, the underdog as a human rights lawyer, but you've also co-authored a book, Silenced Women, Why the Law Fails Women and How to Fight Back. Can you tell us a bit more about your book and why it's necessary?
Well, as a lawyer working with journalists and media organisations in media defence work, my colleague and I were frustrated seeing the number of stories about gender-based violence and women's stories that were being spiked pre-Me Too. Then, of course, we saw the Me Too movement with women breaking this cultural silence to speak out about their experiences, which is clearly in the public interest. And then this legal backlash, defamation claims, non-disclosure agreements. We were seeing this in our practice. Women being sued, being threatened with suit, being silenced, being censored for having spoken out about their experience of abuse. And so we decided to write a book about it.
So you detected Me Too, women speaking out, and then a backlash, get back in your box, ladies.
Exactly. So what we're seeing is the law being weaponized to reinforce the status quo of silence. We can't grapple with the problem of violence against women. The most prolific human rights abuse in the world, 1 in 3 women will suffer sexual assault, 1 in 4 domestic violence. But how can we possibly begin to grapple with it if we can't even talk about it?
Fabulous point. More about that later. Let's go back to Glasgow in 1862 now to see if we can find the missing maid. Jessie Macpherson sleeps in the basement of the house in Sandyford Place, in a room behind the kitchen. She works for three men. There's old Mr. James Fleming, his son John Fleming, and then his son, another John. The oldest Fleming started out as a handloom weaver, then set up a successful manufacturing business. his son's an accountant. This is an upwardly mobile, respectable family occupying a three-story townhouse. Jessie's 35. She's had two children born outside marriage. This is a good steady job for her. There's just one problem. Recently, Jessie bumped into a female friend and confided something.
I do not feel very happy or comfortable with old Mr. Fleming, for he is actually an old wretch and an old devil.
Jessie won't say any more because her friend's husband is present. It seems likely to me that old Mr. Fleming has been sexually harassing her, perhaps even worse than that. Jen, shall we speculate about why she might feel inhibited?
Women have historically found it very difficult to speak about their experience of gender-based violence, particularly back at this time. And we also have to consider the power imbalance between her and her employer. As a young woman in this very vulnerable situation where you're working in someone's home, her livelihood is at risk if she's overheard speaking in those terms about the family for whom she works, and potentially her safety.
If you're asleep in your employer's house, you're vulnerable, aren't you?
Precisely.
Do you think it's got any easier for women to speak out since then?
Culturally, I think it's much easier now than it was certainly at that time. But from a legal point of view, the laws are still very challenging and difficult. People see these big famous defamation cases that end up in the courts, but so much of what we see as lawyers in practice is you'll never see it. It will never reach the public domain. So if a woman tweets in the context of the Me Too movement, I was raped by my boyfriend when I was 16, that person, and it happens a lot, will end up with a legal threat letter threatening her with defamation because even though he wasn't named, he could be identified by the tweet by her age and who she was dating at that time. And for many women, the cost risk of being sued, it is incredibly expensive in this country to defend a defamation case. The cost risk is enough for her to self-censor, to take down the tweet, to even apologise publicly, and to never speak about it again. Now, that happens in the context of survivors, so women who speak out about their own experience on social media or even to friends, but also journalists. So there's so many stories when a legal threat letter arrives, even large media organisations often don't have the legal budget to report these stories. And so powerful, wealthy men know that the mere threat of litigation can be enough to silence a story, whether it's a media organisation or a woman. My grandmother worked in the domestic violence refuge movement in Australia. After being a survivor of domestic violence and leaving my violent grandfather, dedicated her life to trying to make it easier for women in her position and to contribute to ending violence against women. And I remember sitting with her some years ago and she was really depressed. I asked her what was wrong and she said, well, the statistics of violence against women haven't improved since I retired from the refuge movement 20 years ago. And I thought, well, you did your time. You spent your life working in this. What am I doing about it? What can I do as a free speech lawyer? And so in the post-Me Too world, I saw that opportunity because we're seeing so much of so many women being silenced because they want to speak out about their abuse but are being sued. And so using my skills towards that end is why we wrote the book.
So you're here partly to honour your grandmother.
Exactly.
That's nice. Yeah. Let's keep looking for Jessie McPherson. On Friday the 4th of July, 1862, the middle and the youngest Mr. Flemings go away for the weekend. Jessie McPherson finds herself alone in the house with old Mr. Fleming. On Saturday morning, as we've heard, the milk boy calls and is turned away. Then on Monday, after work, the younger Mr. Flemings return. Old Mr. Fleming says he hasn't seen the maid all weekend and that her bedroom door is locked. His son finds a key, opens the door, and is confronted by an appalling sight.
Lying on the floor, face downwards, not far from the bedstead, lay, nearly nude, the disfigured body of the murdered woman.
There are deep gashes across Jessie McPherson's forehead and nose, and her head has been smashed in. The middle Mr. Fleming runs to call the neighbours, the police and a doctor, who declares that she must have been dead for some time. The police notice that Jessie's best clothes are missing, along with some of the Flemings' silverware. Certain areas of the kitchen floor have been washed recently. They're still wet. In Jessie's bedroom, though, There are three footprints in blood.
The bedclothes also were saturated with blood. The many parts of her apparel found scattered about the room were bloodstained and had evidently been torn off either hurriedly or by a person not much skilled in doffing feminine habiliments.
A person not much skilled in removing women's clothing. That's a clue. A post-mortem shows that while Jessie's injuries are truly grim, I'm quoting here, the comparatively light degree of strength shown in the blows would point to a female or a weak man having inflicted them. Jen, this is very horrible, isn't it? What do you think of the crime scene so far?
Well, it's obvious from the circumstances in the post-mortem that she's been attacked, and who would be motivated, who had access to the home to attack her in that way? That's the question.
Well, the police ask those very questions and, like me, conclude that the most likely suspect is old Mr. Fleming. He's arrested and questioned for 4 hours, after which, in a surprising move, the police go and arrest someone else entirely different. Meet Jessie McLaughlin, a former servant at Sandyford Place. She's 28 years old and married with a 3-year-old son. Yes, this is another Jessie, but stick with me, this will make sense. Jessie McLaughlin is reportedly pretty friendly with Jessie McPherson, but somehow she ends up charged with her murder while old Mr. Fleming is released scot-free. How on earth does this happen? Well, the investigation turns up several pieces of evidence that put Jessie McLaughlin at the scene of the crime, despite her protestations to the contrary. She uses a false name to pawn the Flemings' missing silver. She stashes a box full of Jessie McPherson's missing clothes at a railway station. One of her own dresses is found bloodstained and abandoned in a field 10 miles from Glasgow. And a rather revolting experiment shows that her footprints match the bloody tracks left in McPherson's bedroom almost exactly. Every time Jessie McLaughlin is confronted with a new piece of evidence, she changes her story, giving 3 different statements in quick succession. She will stand trial for murder. Jen, now Jessie's statements, they appear to be reactive and at times contradictory. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think that making a muddled statement means that you're guilty of murder, does it?
Well, it doesn't, but it means that you're not considered a credible witness. So giving multiple inconsistent statements does indicate to a fact finder, to a judge, to a jury that there's something wrong with your story and that you're not telling the truth. Defence counsel in this case should have been sitting down and having a frank conversation with her to understand what actually happened, what pressure she may have come under or otherwise, or what is motivating her concern and her potential fear about giving a truthful account.
Yeah. A month before her trial, Jessie gives a final statement to her lawyers from prison. And this time, she tells a very different story. Jessie McLaughlin admits that she was at the Flemings' house the night that her friend was killed. But she now insists that old Mr. Fleming is the murderer.
He's an old murderer. He did the deed. The guilty is got out and the innocent is kept in.
You'd think that this would change everything. Her defence team now has a good explanation of what happened. But they decide it's too risky to admit that she was at Sandyford Place at all. The lawyers, all men, make an executive decision. They won't present Jessie McLaughlin's story to the all-male jury. They'll run her defence on the basis that the prosecution cannot prove that she was definitely at the crime scene that night. Now, Jessie McLaughlin says that old Mr. Fleming killed her friend Jessie McPherson. But old Mr. Fleming has somehow incriminated Jessie herself, and she's now standing trial for this murder. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same thing, but I've heard of something called DARVO tactics. Can you tell me what that is?
DARVO is an acronym that stands for Deny, Reverse, Victim and Offender. It's a tactic used by perpetrators to avoid accountability and place the blame elsewhere. So in this circumstance, if our theory about the case is correct, and he did in fact kill Jessie, and Jessie's friend Jessie was a witness to that fact, and he has put pressure on her, she is in fact the victim of a crime. That is witness intimidation and perverting the course of justice. And yet he's accusing her of being the murderer.
Clever and bad.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachim.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go back to the story. Jesse's trial begins on the 17th of September, 1862, at Glasgow High Court. Old Mr. Fleming, once the prime suspect, is now the star witness for the prosecution.
I can say no more than I have. I've told you everything in my heart. Be as easy as you can. I'm willing to answer every question.
His account of the weekend of the murder is muddled and contradictory. He says that he heard squeals from the basement at 4 a.m. on the Saturday morning, but he didn't bother to investigate. He says that Jessie McPherson, the maid, had disappeared, but he assumed she'd gone off with friends. Who was squealing then? He denies answering the door to the milk boy early on Saturday morning, only to change his mind when cross-examined.
Why did you not let Jessie open the door when the milk boy came?
On Saturday morning, you mean?
Yes, on Saturday morning.
Jessie, you can. Oh, it was over with Jessie afore that.
Old Mr. Fleming implicates himself left, right and centre. But the judge seems determined to let this respectable elderly man off the hook. And the judge also seems to really have it in for Jessie McLaughlin. When he delivers his four-hour summing up, he brings with him the black cap that he'll need to put onto his head slowly if Jessie is sentenced to death. That seems a bit premature to me, Mr. Judge. But sure enough, the verdict's guilty. Next, something quite remarkable happens. Through her barrister, Jessie asks for her most recent statement to be read aloud. The one her defence team chose not to use in court, the one they've had in their pocket all along. Jessie now throws the veil off her face. She stands up in the dock and she says, in a loud and distinct voice,
I am as innocent as my child, who is only 3 years of age.
I'm happy to say that our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone, is here to talk us through this new version of events. Hello, Ros.
Hello, Lucy, and hello, Jen.
Hi, Ros.
So what did Jessie say?
Well, I've examined the floor plans for Sandyford Place, so we should be able to walk through each step of her statement. Jessie says that on the evening of Friday the 4th of July, she put her son to bed and then set off to visit her friend Jessie McPherson at Sandyford Place. She finds McPherson having a drink with old Mr. Fleming in the kitchen, in the basement at the back of the house. Old Mr. Fleming sends Jessie McLaughlin out to buy whiskey, but the shop is shut and she comes back to Sandyford Place. Old Mr. Fleming answers the back door and she goes through to the kitchen. But there's no sign of McPherson. Jessie follows the old man into the passageway.
I heard her moaning in the laundry. I went and passed the old man, who seemed at first inclined to stop me. I found Jessie lying on the floor. She had a large wound across her brow and her nose was cut, and she was bleeding a great deal. I saw her hair all down, and she had nothing on but a polka in her shift.
So she's wearing a polka, that's a tight jacket, and a shift, that's something like a petticoat today.
Yeah, I mean, really, this whole scenario screams sexual assault to me. But old Mr. Fleming claims that there'd been an accident, and for several hours, Jessie tends to McPherson's wounds as she falls in and out of consciousness. In a moment of lucidity, McPherson tells Jessie that old Mr. Fleming had come home drunk recently and got into her bed.
He came to her room and tried to use liberties with her. She made an outcry about it and was angry.
McPherson says old Mr. Fleming is terrified she'll tell old Mr. Fleming's son, and he offers her money to keep her quiet.
At this point then, Jessie McPherson is still alive. Why doesn't Jessie McLaughlin send for help?
She tries to, but old Mr. Fleming locks her in the house.
No.
Yeah. At one point, she runs up to the first floor to try to attract the attention of someone outside the house. She hears a noise, runs back downstairs to the basement and then witnesses old Mr. Fleming striking her friend on the side of the head with a meat chopper.
My goodness, he's used a meat chopper. So Jessie McPherson is dead, and I guess Jessie McLaughlin's thinking that she might be next.
Yes.
Oh, let me away. Let me go. For the love of God, let me go away.
In the event, old Mr. Fleming doesn't hurt Jessie McLaughlin, but he issues an awful threat.
Don't be feared. Only if you tell your no about her death, you will be taken in for it as well as I. My life's in your power, and yours is in my power.
According to Jessie McLaughlin, this is the point that old Mr. Fleming now pressures her into taking the silver plate and Jessie McPherson's clothes to try to make it look like a violent robbery has taken place. Jen, what do you think about all of this? How does it strike you?
Her credibility has been questioned because she's given so many different accounts. Mm. But it is a much more plausible account of events and is consistent with the broader context. We've got this history of conduct by him. And of course, he has motive to kill Jessie because he's concerned that she's going to speak out about what he's been doing to her.
As you can imagine, Jessie McLaughlin's statement causes a huge stir. But undeterred, the judge puts on his black cap and sentences her to death by hanging. However, many people are deeply uncomfortable with this verdict and they begin a campaign to get it changed. Roz, can you tell us more about what happened?
Public opinion is just completely divided. There are people on the side of the Flemings and there are those that support Jessie.
So it's your classic he said, she said situation.
Yes, that's right. At the time, there are two influential newspapers in Glasgow, the Morning Journal and the Glasgow Herald. They're kind of rivals. Let's have a look at what both papers are saying on a particular day, the 24th of September, 1862, just a few days after the trial. The Morning Journal calls the verdict a great injustice. The paper is backing a petition to delay Jessie's execution, and it praises her for remaining so calm and composed in prison. The Herald, in contrast, really objects to this campaign in the strongest possible terms, and here's what they say.
For the sentiments of those who have carefully read and have earnestly weighed the whole body of the evidence, we have much respect. Even although it might easily be shown that their views on the matter are erroneous.
Well, we all know that when somebody says with respect, they're about to say that they completely disagree with you. And that's what's happened there. Now, Jen, I suspect that the court of public opinion is still a thing and something you perhaps experienced when you represented Amber Heard. Is that correct?
So I represented Amber Heard in respect of the unsuccessful defamation proceedings that Johnny Depp took against the Sun newspaper here in the United Kingdom. In that case, the judge found that he had been violent towards her. So we were successful in proving the truth of her allegations of domestic violence. Then he sued her personally in the United States, and there was a jury trial where she was the defendant. I was not her counsel in that case, and she lost before a jury. She filed an appeal, but they later settled the case, so she didn't go through to the appeal. So we have a ruling from a judge in this country, and I encourage people to read that written judgment that sets out the evidence, and a finding by a jury in Virginia that is completely the opposite.
And which do you think is right? The one in the UK, obviously.
In my view, the judge in this country got it right.
There was intense media interest in the case, wasn't there?
There was. I remember getting phone calls from friends during the trial saying, it doesn't seem to be going well for her. And I found that interesting. They were obviously reading media reports because for us in court, it was clear to me that it was going well for her. So it's interesting how evidence is reported and how that affects public opinion. It also shows the role of the media in revealing evidence of miscarriage of justice and running campaigns to help exonerate people. And we see that in this case.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? The petition calling for Jessie's execution to be delayed attracts tens of thousands of signatures and it works. The Home Secretary opens an official inquiry, and as a result, Jessie's sentence is commuted to life imprisonment. When Jessie's released after 15 years in 1877, she's 44. Her son's grown up. Her husband has moved to Australia and remarried. Jessie can't settle in Scotland because she gets recognised wherever she goes. She emigrates to America. She marries again. And she dies in Michigan in 1899. Was, I find this really sad that Jessie McLaughlin's life gets so thrown off track by all of this. If she was telling the truth and if she didn't hurt her friend. What's your response?
Well, sadly, we'll never know the truth. I mean, it is quite possible that Jessie was innocent and she was just terrified and afraid. But the writer Jack House, who has included this case in his book Square Mile of Murder, has suggested that perhaps she was a pathological liar. I mean, she gives multiple statements to the police and they contain lies. And even that statement she gives in the courtroom, which sounds plausible, still contain lies. So I can kind of see where he's coming from. And wait for it. Here's a twist. Later on, she actually confesses.
What? She confessed to doing the murder?
Yes. In prison, after she had been granted a reprieve, she gave a fifth statement to her lawyer in which she confessed to the crime. Now, it's not clear what's going on here. This was a woman at the beginning of a very long prison sentence, and it's highly possible she was doing this just to get a reaction from her lawyer, just to be heard, because this is really a case about women struggling to get their voice across, women who are silenced.
Okay. I didn't think that she did it, and I'm rather thrown by the fact that, in fact, she has confessed. Gosh, yeah. What do you make of all of this, Jen?
Well, I agree. This case shows how difficult it was for women to speak out about their abuse at that time. She was clearly done a disservice by her lawyers, who didn't do the work they needed to do to properly defend her and find out the reasons behind these inconsistent stories to make that strategic decision not to put her evidence before the court, where she explains what happened. But it also reflects the way that women were treated in the criminal justice system at that time.
Jen, we've been talking here about a very dark and horrible case, but let's look for the light. In your work, what do you see changing for the better? Do you find any hope on the horizon?
I do. And while this is a massive global problem with the laws being weaponized to silence women, what I find really encouraging is that women are standing together to speak out. I have a lot of hope for the future, but we have to keep pushing. This is what I say, for example, about Amber Heard and her experience in the US trial, where we saw this global online discussion of the case. Everyone was Team Johnny or Team Amber. And the ways people speak about Amber online were perpetrating these male-centric tropes and stereotypes that she's a liar, she's crazy, she's a gold digger. Johnny Depp and Amber Heard aren't going to see what you said about that case, but you know who will have heard it? Other women in your life who have suffered violence and have never spoken about it. And do you think they will tell you their story if they've seen the way you spoke about that case? And I think people need to ask themselves that question.
Mm. Well, what we see in this case is a pattern of silencing. It looks like old Mr. Fleming silences Jessie McPherson using horrifying violence before silencing the only witness, her friend Jessie McLaughlin. Then in court, Jessie McLaughlin is silenced by her own defence team and even by the judge who's meant to get her a fair trial. Does the law still silence women today? In many cases, it would certainly seem so. What can this case perhaps teach us? Maybe it's the importance of not being silenced easily, of using your voice, and if you can find the courage, do speak out. Next time, join me in late Victorian London, where the gruesome murder of a young woman stokes a growing obsession with true crime. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Sarah Goodman, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Bill Hope, Jonathan Keeble, and Ruth Sillers. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen first to the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. See you next time.
If journalism is the first draft of history, what happens if that draft turns out to be flawed? In 1999, four apartment buildings were blown up in Russia, hundreds killed. But 25 years on, we still don't know for sure who did it. It's a mystery that sparked chilling theories. Because these bombs, they're part of the origin story of one of the most powerful men in the world, Vladimir Putin. I'm Helena Merriman, and in a new BBC series, I'm talking to the reporters who first covered this story. What did they miss first time round? The History Bureau, Putin and the apartment bombs. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.